This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. President Donald Trump scuttles a secret meeting at Camp David to advance U.S. Taliban peace talks aimed at ending the 18-year conflict. Shortly thereafter, he ousts his national security advisor, John Bolton, who was opposed to the peace deal with the militant group. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. This month, as we commemorate the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks on U.S. soil, we look at the status of al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS, in Afghanistan, and how, when, and if the United States should draw down on the 14,000 U.S. troops currently stationed in the South Asian country. Washington launched the war in Afghanistan following the September 11, 2001 terror attacks to drive the Taliban from power for providing a safe haven and base of operations for al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Despite the war, which has taken a devastating toll on Afghanistan, civilians, security forces, and infrastructure, it continues unabated, and the Taliban control more territory than the Afghan government. Moreover, as the U.S. 2020 election looms, President Trump and many Democratic candidates sense war weariness on the part of the American electorate and seek a way out without compromising U.S. national security. But while welcoming the U.S. Taliban talks led by U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad, many former U.S. ambassadors to Afghanistan and other Afghan experts question whether the militant group, which does not recognize the legitimacy of the Afghan government, refuses to accept a ceasefire, and has been slaughtering Afghan civilians and security forces while negotiating, can be trusted. For now, President Trump says the talks are, quote, dead. No one, perhaps with the exception of the now-deposed John Bolton, is more pleased with the turn of events than Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, whose government was excluded from the U.S.-Taliban peace talks. Analysts say that by breaking off negotiations, Mr. Trump has effectively cleared the path for Mr. Ghani to win presidential elections scheduled for September 28. Among the provisions, the U.S. administration agreed to a partial and sequenced U.S. troop withdrawal in exchange for the Taliban's commitment to cut ties with al-Qaeda and ensure that no terrorist attacks against the United States are conducted on Afghan soil. Well, with us to analyze the state of play between the United States and Afghanistan are two distinguished analysts. Ambassador Ronald Newman is the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy. Prior to joining the group, he served as ambassador to Algeria, Bahrain, and Afghanistan. And Scott Worden, he's the director of Afghanistan and Central Asia Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Prior to joining the U.S. Institute of Peace, he was a senior policy advisor at the U.S. Agency for International Development, responsible for advising senior officials on strategies in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Scott Worden, let me begin with you. What is your reaction to this chain of events, the U.S. Taliban talks without the Afghan government, the now scuttled Camp David meeting, and the removal of National Security Advisor John Bolton?
Well, it has been a dramatic turn of events here in Washington over the past week. There was great anticipation that some kind of a deal between the U.S. and the Taliban had been reached. The details of that deal are still very unclear. Of course, now it is paused, if not dead. I think the proper perspective, however, is that the deal between the United States and the Taliban, as important as that is really one part of the larger process to try to end the conflict in Afghanistan. What everybody was hoping for and was discussed as part of the U.S.-Taliban deal is intra-Afghan negotiations. So negotiations between the Taliban and the Afghan government, as well as civil society leaders, other political elites, so that they can resolve the fundamentals of the conflict in a political settlement. That still needs to happen. The U.S.-Taliban deal was hoped for as a gateway to that next important process. We didn't cross the threshold here, but the need to figure out how to get the Afghans talking to each other and how to resolve the underlying political differences that fuel this conflict remains.
Turning to you, Ambassador Newman, for your take on the chain of events, and notwithstanding what some considered troubling optics, the fact of having the Taliban, who basically were responsible for the 9/11 terror attacks, come to Camp David, how do you see the current chain of events?
Well, I think, first of all, Scott has framed the issue exactly correctly. I think it's really important to step back and say, what are our major interests in Afghanistan still? And they remain homeland security, concern about al-Qaeda, and now you have the Islamic State in Afghanistan. And it may not be possible to have a military victory. You can certainly have a military defeat. And it is still in the interest of the United States not to have a military defeat, and if possible, to negotiate a peace. But the issue is to negotiate a peace that protects our interests, not just to admit defeat and depart. So that's why Scott's framing was terribly important. What counts is whether our negotiation with the Taliban is a part of a peace process or undermines it. So there are a couple of key questions that I and some other ambassadors have raised, but a great many other analysts as well. And these are things which are not clear in what we know about the negotiations. So one is, will we continue to provide air support, particularly air support, but other kinds of military support, to the Afghan forces as we withdraw? Or are we dropping them? I would anticipate that if we dropped them, this would be exactly what President Obama did. We stopped air support for 2 years, cost the Afghan forces enormously in casualties and lost terrain. I would hope President Trump would not repeat what is very obviously a mistake that was made by President Obama. Secondly, one should expect negotiations will go on a long time. There's years of war. There are huge differences. We don't even know if peace is possible. We don't know if the Taliban, the Islamic Emirate, is prepared to have any other form of government. So a lot we don't know. And so we have to see this agreement. I am perfectly happy with the collapse of the idea of the meeting at Camp David. The negotiations need to continue. These issues are far too complicated to resolve in a photo op at Camp David. The idea of reopening the negotiations, which is apparently what the president wanted, is completely contrary to the way Afghans pursue negotiations. I don't know whether the Taliban were refusing to come or not, but I think that would have been a very dangerous way to proceed, more likely to break down than to produce anything. And I think that any handshake it produced would not have been part of any solid peace. We do need to go back to negotiations.
With the Taliban.
With the Taliban. And we need to make sure that that is part of a pathway to a negotiations with an Afghan government.
So back to you, Scott Worden, regarding the status of al-Qaeda, which is the original reason why we are in Afghanistan, to remove al-Qaeda, to have the Taliban deny a safe haven to al-Qaeda. We know that ISIS is on the rise. What is the status of these terrorist groups in Afghanistan? Because as Ambassador Newman said, first and foremost, the United States is concerned about the security of the homeland. And those groups, particularly al-Qaeda, may still have the capacity to strike the homeland.
Well, there certainly still is a presence of terrorist groups with global ambition in Afghanistan. And I think that with deteriorating security and increasing Taliban control of territory, the possibility for safe havens to be used against the U.S. is also increasing. So the threat is there. There are different views, and it's really an intelligence question that I don't know the answer to, about how many al-Qaeda are left. They're vastly diminished, not just since 2001, but even during the period of the U.S. military surge, there are not very many al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan by many accounts. ISIS is the greater and growing concern, and they, of course, have clear global ambition against the United States and our allies. So whether it's al-Qaeda, which, of course, is important because of their role in 9/11, but really on the terror issue, it's ISIS, whether they have the capability to attack the U.S., it will only increase as the conflict in Afghanistan increases. A lot of discussion was spent on what kinds of assurances would the Taliban give? What kind of guarantees? Is their word worth anything? Can we trust them? No, we can't trust them. But the more fundamental issue is that as the conflict expands and increases in Afghanistan, the areas that the government control decrease and the opportunities for al-Qaeda or ISIS or the next generation increase as well. So there has to be a political settlement to this conflict to remove those safe havens, not based on guarantees of one combatant or the other, but based on government control and actual peace and stability.
So after the Taliban gives this assurance,
Exactly. They need to come to the table, but there needs to be fundamentally, at the end of the process, a ceasefire where Afghans can control their own territory and then be aware of who is there and who's the threat.
So, Ambassador Newman, feel free to add or subtract to what Scott said, and also your take on to what extent the Taliban will, in fact, keep its word, even if it really depends on the second stage. So that is another question. To what extent are you optimistic or feel confident that the Taliban will engage in intra-Afghan talks with a government that they see currently as illegitimate?
If you asked me to bet on their willingness to keep a promise, I would say no. I mean, we have a lot of Afghan agreements we can look at over the last 40 years of war between Afghan groups. None of those agreements were kept by anybody. They were very much like agreements between European powers in the Middle Ages. You kept it until you were powerful enough to change it. So any agreement we make with the Taliban has to be buffered by ways of verification, by ways of enforcement. But this is why it's so important to have a larger peace process. If your answer is, we're going to get out trusting a promise of a terrorist group to prevent another terrorist group from striking us while they fight a third terrorist group that hasn't promised anything, and we're going to leave the government in the lurch to collapse under these pressures, I don't think that's much of an agreement.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Ronald Newman, President of the American Academy of Diplomacy, from whom you just heard, and Scott Worden. He's Director of the Afghanistan and Central Asia Program at the United States Institute of Peace. We're reviewing developments in Afghanistan in the wake of the suspension of talks between Washington and the Taliban. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Now here's a shout out to a very loyal listener, Tor Wapera from Enugu, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to you, Scott Worden. I want to pick up on something that Ambassador Newman said. He said that all of this, that is the Taliban peace process, should be part of a larger process. Does that mean that we need to engage other actors? And if so, who are they? And are they willing to engage besides just the United States and the NATO allies and regional players?
They do need to be inclusive discussions, and they need to be inclusive within Afghanistan as well as in the broader region. So it's important to know that in Afghanistan, the Taliban obviously are fighting the government, but the government itself has a lot of different political factions. Women as a gender have concerns that are particular to any deal with the Taliban and not wanting a return to their really oppressive rule. So the Afghan negotiations that I referred to earlier have to represent different political and ethnic factions that should be under the umbrella of the government. But in fact, the political landscape there is fragmented, and efforts need to be made to have the Afghan conversation be inclusive. Looking beyond Afghanistan, the neighbors, particularly Pakistan, have provided support and safe haven to the Taliban. They are a major factor in any negotiation. And great powers, whether it's Russia or China, obviously the U.S. and our NATO allies, have a significant influence on different factions within the country. I think one of the significant achievements of the negotiations that failed to conclude was that the neighboring powers really did agree with the U.S.'s approach to negotiations. They want a political settlement. They want, for better or for worse, a reduction in U.S. forces because the neighbors are not always, in fact, are not our friends. So they saw good things coming out of a possible settlement if it could be achieved. And I think for a brief period of time, they were supportive. Going forward, it's a major question, to what extent can the region support a peace process, not support the Taliban in the failure of this deal to occur, and really work to pressure all sides that they control to try to come to a compromise that is political.
Ambassador Newman, how do you see the role of outsiders, countries who could play a very constructive role over the long run?
Oh, there are any number who could play a constructive role, whether they will or not. Pakistan, Iran, and Russia are the three of greatest concern. And with all three, the roles are a little unclear and have changed over time. Scott made another point, though, that I think is really worth emphasizing to Afghans. Afghans have an election coming up. I believe that election will take place. As far as I know, U.S. government policy still supports holding of that election. But a number of candidates are running rather ethnic campaigns. Whoever wins the election, there will be an enormous need for them to open up and bring other ethnic and political forces in. If Dr. Ghani is the winner, he needs to do that far more than he has done now. His government is seen as primarily a Pashtun government. That would be a very difficult way to produce an agreement that other Afghans would live with. But Dr. Abdullah has run a largely Tajik campaign. There are other candidates. There are 18 running. Whoever wins, they are going to have to do a lot better than anybody in Afghanistan has done in the last period to have a more inclusive government if they're going to have a peace negotiation that works.
Very good. Let me turn to Scott Worden for your take on some of the shortcomings of the Afghan government, the likes of which Mr. Ambassador just mentioned, and whether or not you think that the elections on September 28th can go forward safely and can produce an outcome that will advance the peace process.
Well, I very much agree with Ambassador Newman's comments on the need for whoever is the next Afghan president to open up a bigger, more inclusive tent and be accommodating of whoever the losers are. One of the problems that exacerbates the conflict in Afghanistan is the system of government is very centralized, and it's perceived by political factions as a winner-take-all contest, because whoever controls the presidency controls patronage and appointments all the way down to the district level. So to counteract the fear that whoever the losing candidate or team will have of being shut out of politics and shut out of economic opportunities for the next 5 years, you have to form some kind of government coalition that, under the authority of the president, accommodates different political factions. As to the chances for this occurring, I agree it's a consistently recognized need, even by Afghans, but doing it is very hard. In any political campaign, you have to overpromise to your supporters, and then you promise too much of the pie to share among even your allies when you win. So this will be a very difficult process after the election. I have to say, the other big risk of these elections is violence and low participation. Unfortunately, the trend line for each Afghan election has been lower participation and or more violence. And the Taliban have said, as they do in the past, that they plan to attack these elections. Voters were not able to register in many locations that they could vote before. And so I think you will have low turnout. If it's a close race, it will be hotly contested as to the fidelity of the results. And the solution really is to signal to the losers they will not be shut out of politics in the future government.
Well, speaking of the Afghan government, let's turn quickly to the Taliban. They must also have divisions within their ranks. To what extent does the suspension of talks strengthen the hardliners? How does this affect the Taliban in their strategy going forward?
There certainly are divisions within the Taliban. I think it will be very interesting to see over the coming weeks what comes out as far as regrets that the Taliban may have, that this deal got away from them. But fundamentally, they have presented a remarkably unified negotiating position. They have their political team in Doha. They were negotiating, but clearly in contact with their leadership, Shura, and the military commanders back in Pakistan as well as Afghanistan. You can certainly say this is a victory for the hardliners. They are more likely to want to press their military advantage, accelerate the gains that they have been slowly making, but making over time. And surely there's a faction that seeks total control of Afghanistan and thinks if they can wait out the Americans, they can get a better deal or maybe get the whole deal later on. I would also finally add that for the ordinary Afghans, they're the ones that are really suffering in this. And the United Nations has been keeping civilian casualty statistics over many years. They are higher now than they've ever been. And so the cost of the war is tremendous on ordinary Afghans, and that includes the Taliban. So it should hopefully press for some kind of resumption of talks seeking a political compromise.
Your take, Ambassador Newman, with regard to the Taliban?
I think up to now, the Taliban have been negotiating on the premise that basically they've won, and they're looking for what verbal concessions they have to make to get the U.S. out, and then they'll deal with the Afghans. It's not clear to me that they're prepared to negotiate anything else, except maybe a sort of a sharing of power within the structure of the Islamic Emirate. Whether that view of their position changes now, it's too early to tell. They're still doing their own internal assessments, and I suspect those won't be done quickly. One of the big questions is, if we're suspending negotiations, what's the United States doing? Is it still going to take troops out? Is it not going to take troops out? Is it going to renew its pledge, even if it takes troops out, to maintain long-term support of the Afghan government and military? I think it should do those things, but that's just me. So those decisions of the American government, which are highly opaque right now, will have a great deal to do with how the Taliban react to the failure.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to sort of conclude on that note, and that is back to the United States and to what extent domestic political pressure is driving Mr. Trump to want to withdraw, as well as the Democrats as we approach the 2020 elections. It's been 18 years. The Taliban are in greater control than ever. The war goes on. People are war weary. And yet we have very important national security concerns with respect to Afghanistan. But we need, at the same time, some way to break this stalemate. So to you, Scott Worden, how do you see the interplay of these factors on what the United States does? And we can't, of course, ignore the, some would call it chaos in the national security establishment, now that National Security Advisor John Bolton has left and things are in a bit of a disarray.
Certainly there's an increasing consensus on both the Republican and the Democratic side that we should find a way to wind down the war in Afghanistan. Of course, everybody says we should do that responsibly, and that includes protecting our national security interests. I think what's remarkable about the Afghanistan policy debate is that for several different administrations in a row, both Republican and Democratic, there have been the same dilemmas. And there has been a very consistent policy, which is, this is a long-term problem. We don't want to pull out troops and risk a military failure. And yet a recognition that we don't have sufficient power or resources to fix it on our own. And that has produced the enduring stalemate that we find ourselves in. And I think this reversal on whether to sign a deal with the Taliban reflects a still unresolved fundamental difference in view about, do you look at this from a, we need to protect against a certain risk of terrorist attack, or do we need to focus on other problems? I do agree with one of your premises that the status quo is not going to solve the problem. So I think it is a risk and reward calculation. What risk is there acceptable to try to get out of the current mold? Maybe this deal was not the right way to go about it, but something needs to change because the underlying dynamics are consistent and it will not lead to a military victory. And something needs to happen to provoke a new conversation, again, among Afghans, so that we can withdraw.
And you get the last word, Ambassador Newman.
Everybody pretty much wants to get out responsibly. There are a lot of commentators using the we need to get out and we need to do it responsibly as, frankly, a kind of cheap tagline for not dealing with the problem of how do you do that. So there's a lot of grumpiness. The pressure is mostly Mr. Trump's, because despite the grumpiness, the fact is Afghanistan is not in the top 10 of almost anybody's list of issues on which they will decide their vote. And there is a general consensus on what I call the cheap tagline, that we want to get out responsibly. So there's not a clear difference between candidates. It's not an issue on which there seems to be any move in Congress to cut off funding. So, yeah, there's a lot of commentary. Real pressure? No. President has plenty of freedom to make whatever decision he wants to make. He may have pressure in his own mind because of what he wants to accomplish. But the discussion of domestic political pressure is actually vastly exaggerated.
That is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador Ron Newman, President of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and Scott Worden. Director of the Afghanistan and Central Asia Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Gentlemen, thank you for a terrific conversation. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondette. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.